Since, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is rebirth, a logical necessity. We know that on this subject of rebirth, the world is divided at least into two major groups, believers and non-believers. Of course, a small minority is quite indifferent to the whole question whether we are born again or not. But even if we see believers and non-believers, mostly the belief arises because you are born into a particular religion and that religion teaches rebirth. Like generally the Hindus, the Buddhists will say that yes, they do believe in rebirth. A Christian will say he doesn't believe in rebirth. Now, therefore this belief or non-belief is not really a question whether of people having investigated and having reasoned out for themselves that whether there is rebirth, whether something survives death or not. It's more a matter of something which they have imbibed from their culture, from their religion, or if you are of a scientific temper, then once again you will either follow what the leading scientists are saying and so on. Now, all those who have tried to reason out, they have put at least three objections to believing in rebirth. The one great objection to rebirth is that if we have lived before, why do we not remember our past lives? The second objection is that, well, if we have lived before, then this doctrine of rebirth seems to be a very cruel doctrine. If I suffer, I can't even put an end to my life because rebirth doctrine says that I will be born again. So there is no way I can escape from my misery. So again, they are not too happy with the doctrine of rebirth. Those who have miserable life also say, what, one more life of misery? I'd rather believe in eternal heaven with its joys and peace and bliss and so on. But luckily, we are told that the falsehood or truth of this doctrine does not depend upon sentiments. And that is why HBB says that if you even take care to look around yourself, you know, in life, you'll find that when things die, they suddenly don't disappear into thin air. For a long time, some remnants of that thing lingers. So why should you feel that man, who is supposed to be the crown piece of evolution, when he dies, he leaves behind nothing. And suddenly, like a puff of smoke, he is traceless. This is what our first quotation in the handout says. A flower blossoms, then withers and dies. It leaves a fragrance behind, which long after its delicate petals are but a little dust, still linger in the air. Let a note be struck on an instrument, and the faintest sound produces an eternal echo. A disturbance is created on the invisible waves of the shoreless ocean of space, and the vibration is never wholly lost. And a man, we are asked to believe that man, the living, thinking, reasoning entity, the indwelling deity of our nature's crowning masterpiece, will evacuate his casket and be no more. Would the principle of continuity which exists, even for the so-called organic matter, for a floating atom, be denied to that spirit whose attributes are consciousness, memory, mind, love? Really, the very idea is preposterous. So she is just giving us a very simple analogy and shows that, okay, if you observe these things in nature, aren't you, as it were, prodded to think that there must be something surviving man? Now, the whole question then, as is probed by Dr. J. Paul Williams, that whether to believe in rebirth or not, it's all dependent upon what is our concept of man. What is man? Again, three views can be given. Is man just his body? Is man the body that uses soul? Or is he the soul that uses body? And we see that, of course, each one of us knows that man is not just the body. There's something more to us. I mean, each one of us will admit to that. But then what is the relation between body and soul? Again, the analogy is given that candle produces light. You put out the candle and light disappears. But mirror reflects light. You take away the mirror and the light still remains. The light is not dependent on the mirror. And we are told that so the relation between body and soul is like the relation between the light and the mirror. The body may go, but the soul remains. You may argue that we have never had a first-hand experience of the soul. And HBB says that, don't you take, have you ever seen atom? atom with all its neutrons, protons, electrons, because the scientists say we have taken it as a working hypothesis. And she says, why don't you take this also as a working hypothesis? That yes, there is something like soul, which is permanent, eternal, and so on. Secondly, we also have, as it were, an indirect proof coming from those people who have had what is called now as near-death experiences, out-of-the-body experiences. These people narrate, for instance, it is said of Ernest Hemingway that when he was fighting in World War I, he was very mortally wounded, and after a big blow, he says, like a flash, it felt as if like it was like opening of the door of a blast furnace, and I rushed out of my body, and after a while I re-entered. Other person narrating a similar experience has said that, well, I went out of my body, I hovered about my body, and I saw other people gathering around it, and they were crying and so on. I felt regard for the body, but not concern for it. So, once again, it is possible for something, call it soul, ego, immortal spark, whatever you want to call it, there is something in man which can exist independent of the body. That is what this out-of-the-body experiences prove. And that is why in the Gita, Shri Krishna says that when a man dies, it is like a person who throws away the old garment, worn-out garment, and takes on new. So also, the dweller of the body, the Dehi, the Kshetrajna, again, whatever name we want to give, he takes on one new body and leaves off one body which is worn out, which has served its purpose. Now, we can see that therefore we need to make a distinction between possessor and the possessed. When we talk about my books or my dress or my purse, we are very clear in the mind that I possess these books or dress or whatever it is. But I am not that dress or book or whatever. But when, unfortunately, when we talk about my feelings, my ideas, my body, we tend to be so entangled as to think that I am my feelings, I am my body, and therefore we are not able to make the distinction which we need to make. And so HPB says that this, your bundle of experiences, your ideas, your emotions, your body, it forms one kind of I, which she calls as personality. And the very word personality comes from the root persona, meaning mask. And she gives a beautiful analogy saying that in the olden days when the actors used to perform various roles, they used to wear a mask. And the mask will carry the makeup of the role that he is going to play. So if he is going to play Hamlet, the makeup of that role will be there on the mask. The real actor will be always hidden behind the mask. And the actor, while he is performing the role, he is completely involved. But he is all the time aware that he is different from the role that he is playing. Now, unfortunately, she says, in the life we are not aware like this, and therefore we tend to be mixed up with the role of Mr. X or Mrs. Smith, whatever role that we are playing, and we think that we are that particular role or the personality in which we are dwelling. So, the second two quotations, in fact, bring out that thing where Mr. Jajwa says that unless we deny the immortality of man and the existence of soul, there are no sound arguments against the doctrine of pre-existence and rebirth. And HPP says, intimately or rather indissolubly connected with karma, then, is the law of rebirth or of the reincarnation of the same spiritual individuality in a long, almost interminable series of personalities. The latter are like various costumes and characters played by the same actor, with each of which the actor identifies himself and is identified by the public for the space of a few hours. The inner or real man who personates those characters knows the whole time that he is Hamlet for the brief space of few acts, which represent, however, on the plane of human illusion, the whole of life of Hamlet. And he knows that he was, a night before, King Lear, the transformation in his turn of the Othello, of a still earlier preceding night. But the outer visible character is supposed to be ignorant of the fact. In actual life, that ignorance is unfortunately but too real. So, this confusing of the individuality with the personality is what causes problem. And therefore we feel that we are perishable. When the body dies, we are also gone. There is that actor which is hidden, which we call as individuality. And this doctrine, therefore, of rebirth is an old, old doctrine. And ancients have therefore given certain symbols to keep alive this idea in man's memory. For instance, there is a symbol of Phoenix. Phoenix is supposed to be a mythical bird. Phoenix lives for, supposed to live for 500 to 600 years, after which it burns itself on its own funeral pyre and then it is reduced to ashes. Once again from the ashes it arises again on its own. Because we are told that in the ashes there is left a small glowing spark, and that small glowing spark represents this immortal ego in man. That permanent aspect in man which we call as monad or eternal pilgrim reincarnating ego, from which new life can again come about. Another one in classical mythology is the character or the god called Proteus. This Proteus is supposed to be the god who can change form at his will. And it is said that when somebody tries to catch him, he will change his form. Now, the story or the mythology says that one man thought that finally he is going to catch this god. And this god is lying under the tree in the form of a stone. Now, this man, as soon as he tries to touch the stone, it transforms itself into a plant. When he tries to catch the plant, it transforms itself into a serpent. When he tries to kill the serpent, it is transformed into man. When he tries to catch man, he begins to run and suddenly transforms into a luminous being which is seen to be soaring higher and higher. Now we can see so beautifully the whole gamut of evolution that is gone through by this immortal spark, which we call technically as monad, which is supposed to pass through all the lower kingdoms gaining experience, is put in a small mythology, in a short mythology like this. And this is what the Kabbalistic aphorism says, when it says the stone becomes a plant, the plant becomes the animal becomes man, and the man becomes god or angel. And Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi says, where did I ever grow less by dying? Every time that I die, I have, of course it's not an automatic progress, that's what we will see. So this is the gamut of evolution which is brought about in this mythological form. Now naturally therefore the next objection comes that if we have lived for so many lives, why we don't seem to have made any progress? We say that we have left, because the whole evolution from say the mineral kingdom to the animal kingdom has involved millions of years. And then we can see that it's going to take again a lot of time from going from man to becoming angel or a perfected being like Buddha. It is going to involve many years, which is very easy to see. One thing, if we are honestly looking at our lives, what do we find? If you want to learn even single field of knowledge, say you want to master medicine, why? One sub part of medicine, say only ophthalmology or homeopathy, or if you want to master music, or if you want to master biology or computer or mathematics, and you immediately say one life is not sufficient, I can't master it in one life. Or if you want to get over or overcome one of your faults or develop one of the virtues, again one life is not sufficient. Whereas we are told, as Mr. Jack says, that in the infinite universe there are infinite possibilities. Patanjali says in his yoga aphorisms that universe exists for the experience and emancipation of the soul. Light on the Path says that man has to pass through both clean and foul places alike, which means you have to go through various kinds of experiences. And can you think of it? You have to have experience as a housewife, you have to have experience as a prime minister, experience of a servant maid, experience of going through foul places, experience of being a robber, experience of being a prostitute, a homosexual, and there are so many possibilities and so many experiences. And only one life to experience all this. Again, if you are in a male body, you are precluded from having the experience of motherhood. And then there are certain basic or archetypal experiences. For instance, it is said that every soul needs to pass through the experience of poverty. Because when you meet with this experience in a right manner, it is going to inculcate in you fortitude and sympathy. When you meet rightly the experience of poverty, you are able to develop fortitude and sympathy. Now, with only one life and so many possibilities before you, it sounds like it's a joke which is played on man by some god. So this is what Mr. Jack says in the quotation which is in your hand, wherein he points out that viewing life and its probable object with all the varied experience possible for man, one must be forced to the conclusion that a single life is not enough. for carrying out all that is intended by nature, to say nothing of what man himself desires to be. The scale of variety in experience is enormous. There is a vast range of powers latent in man, which we see may be developed if opportunity be given. Knowledge, infinite in scope and diversity, lies before us. We perceive that we have high aspirations with no time to reach up to their measure. To say that we have but one life here with such possibilities put before us and impossible of development is to make the universe and life a huge and cruel joke perpetrated by a powerful God. And as he mentions, there are our own aspirations. We want to pursue so many things. If you are a housewife, you also want to say, have inside you the aspiration to teach, to learn music, to join an NGO, to work for the slum kids, and so on and so forth. And there is only one life. And supposing, having picked up something, you are halfway only in learning it, and suppose you die, then what happens? Like Arjuna asked Shri Krishna, that control of the mind is difficult, but if I die in between, before I have completely learned to control the mind, will all my efforts be wasted up to that point? And the answer is no. Now we can see here a very important point. Something which is of great importance for many people. It's very crucial to know that whether our achievements up to death are going to be lasting or are they going to vanish into thin air when we die is something very important for some people. As for instance, people feel that, is it like going to be like a torch dipped into water? Is it going to be like a puff of smoke going into air? It's going to determine our attitude to life. Why should I struggle? After all, when I die, all my efforts will be lost. No, a person no less than Leo Tolstoy was sunk into deep depression because he thought that all his efforts are going to be wasted once he dies. And therefore, in fact, he contemplated committing suicide. He said, so what if I can write as good as Pushkin writes? After that, when I die, it will be all lost. Luckily, he came across right philosophy and of course the whole view was changed later on. But it is important. How important it is for people to know that, no, my efforts are not lost. As they say, you will pick up the thread from where you have left off. If you have been sewing in the night and if you fall asleep, in the morning when you wake up, you begin sewing from where you have left off. So in the same way, after one life, there is an interval, and that interval is not useless. We are told that all of us go to a state which is called as Devahan, Swarga, Paradise, call that what you may. And it's a state wherein assimilation takes place. When we are on earth life, it's like we are eating food. When we go to Devahan, it's like assimilating this food. And assimilation, which turns into bones, mucus, blood, tissues and so on. So also all those noble and good pursuits of ours, they become part and parcel of the ego. So the ego, when he comes back, it comes back enriched with all these efforts which we had put in some direction or the other. So it's not simply mechanical repetition. Rebirth is not just mechanically dying and once again getting born and once again getting born, but something gets added on, provided we have made the effort in the right direction. So this part is very important. Again, another person called Edmund Wilson, supposed to be lamenting that the knowledge or that death is not so far away, that my mind and emotions and vitality will soon disappear like a puff of smoke, has the effect of making earthly affairs seem unimportant and human beings more and more ignoble. It is harder to take human life seriously, including one's own efforts and achievements. That's why somebody has said, I'm not so much afraid of death as ashamed of it. I'm ashamed of it. That finally, death will overpower us and all our achievements will come to nothing. So, the next then objection comes is, if we have lived so many lives, then why don't we show much progress? And again, in one of the chapters in the Ocean of Theosophy, Mr. Judd says, mere death confers no advance. That the very act of dying does not mean that you will progress. Unless and until you have done something in the life, you have done something useful in the life, only then that will come as a progress, and in the next life you will start at a higher level. So, he says, don't equate progress with rebirth. Rebirth gives you an opportunity to progress. Just like in a given life, it's not necessary that just because a person has lived for 70 years, he is necessarily wise. That's why Buddha has a chapter on old age where he says that you can have a shock of white hair on your head, you can have wrinkled skin, and you would have lived up to 75 or 80, but if you have not gathered soul wealth, you are old in vain. So something similar is true even here, that just because you have lived for hundreds and thousands of lives, not necessary that you will definitely make progress. And again there, again Buddha only points out that very few people, he compares evolution with climbing a mountain, and points out that very few people have that stamina, that perseverance to take the rugged path, so that they take their evolution into their own hands and climb to the top of the mountain in very few lives. Most of us, majority of us, he says, we go from ledge to ledge, resting many a times in between, and very, very slowly we make a progress. So perhaps the progress is made, but it's a very slow, imperceptible progress which is made. And this is what is very beautifully brought out in that little book, which probably all of us have read, must have read sometime or the other in our lives, Jonathan Livingston's Seeker. It is the book of that seeker called Jonathan. And the simile, the analogy is very apt, that out of all these seagulls, there's only one, Jonathan, who suddenly comes to the realization that there is more to life. More to life than finding food, fighting in the flock with each other, trying to get ascendancy over others and so on. And therefore, the leader of the flock, who is supposed to be the person who is advanced, as it were, the seagull, says that yes, it is true that only one in a million of the seagulls aspire like this. After millions of lives, you wake up to the possibility or higher possibilities and think that there is something more to life than eating, drinking, sleeping. And after that, it takes several lifetimes for you to strive in that direction. So in the beautiful words of Richard Bach, you are pretty well a one in a million bird. Most of us came along ever so slowly. We went from one world into another, forgetting right away where we had come from, not caring where we headed, living for the moment. Do you have any idea how many lives we must have gone through before we even got the first idea that there is more to life than eating or fighting or power in the flock? 1,000 lives, John, 10,000. And then another 100 lives until we began to learn that there is such a thing as perfection. And another 100 again to get the idea that our purpose for living is to find that perfection and show it forth. Learn nothing in this world and the next world is the same as this one. So it is not an automatic advance. Learn something and then you will make an advance in the next life. Now, it can happen that in a given life, therefore, you may pursue only one field. And Mr. Jha says that it is rebirth only which can explain the existence of geniuses and child prodigies. That because a person has pursued one field of knowledge, be it computer, be it music, be it medicine. Very recently, India Today had an article on child prodigies where the person of 10-year-old boy is able to perform surgery, or 11-year-old boy is able to pass the highest exam in music, and so on and so forth. So these child prodigies and geniuses, they are not suddenly appearing on the scene of evolution just like that. It's because life after life, the same activity was pursued by the soul, of course at the expense of developing other faculties, that we have geniuses. In that little book for children, Eternal Verities, there are umpteen examples given of these child prodigies, especially the musical prodigies. We are told that Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Chopin, all these were people who at the age of 4 and 5 composed, and at the 7 and 8 years of age they gave public performances. There is the instance given of a blind Tom, who was a Negro boy, a slave boy, and he was working for his master, and once there was a party thrown in which the guest must have played a very difficult piece of piece of music on piano, and when the guest left, he was seen to be playing that music and other difficult pieces of music. Now, at the age of 4 and 5, he had never heard before, he was never taught before. The parents were of course as ignorant as him. And then how was he able to do it? Another instance is of a 4-year-old child in America, where the mother, having to gone out, leave the child to play with newspaper. And when she comes back, she hears somebody loudly reading the newspaper, and when she entered, she saw this little boy of 4 who was never even taught alphabets, was reading the newspaper quite impeccably. Now, how is this? Now, Mr. Jatt says that yes, people might say it's heredity. What heredity? He points out, in fact, many objections, pointing out that heredity cannot confer this sort of a thing unless the ego brings that knowledge. One thing that is said, Napoleon Bonaparte was there. And his lineage was traced out, and it was found that for generations together in that line, there was nobody who showed that kind of power, force, valor, military strategy the way he had. Nobody. You can say atavism and it comes from the 7th generation and all that. But for long, long line, if you see, nobody was there. Then how was he able to display this kind of a thing? It was the ego which brought it. Also, he points out that if Bach was displaying such musical genius, how was it that the subsequent generations, you saw that the musical ability was dying out, and after maybe 3 or 4 generations, the musical ability completely disappeared from his family life. At another place, he gives, there is a pamphlet number 9 on reincarnation, ULT pamphlet number 9. He says, is heredity a puzzle? And gives a very sound argument that if we are going to assign everything to heredity, then we cannot really punish murderers and people who commit crime. Especially when you find that in a family line, there were people whose fathers, forefathers were murderers or those who committed crime, then we can say, yes, it is his heredity. You can't punish him. He gives the example of thugs in India, that for generations this thing was the trade, as it were, of robbing people and killing people was passed on. So is it heredity? He says heredity is only the means used by nature. It is the ego who brings the knowledge, but parents provide the body and maybe the brain which is necessary to express that kind of a thing. But the knowledge is brought by the ego. The blind Tom Negro, his parents didn't know. So they couldn't have possibly passed on the same knowledge to him. So this bringing of knowledge, you can divide into memory, which is physical and mental. There is a mental memory, but there is also physical memory, especially when there is a skill displayed. Because every cell in the body has memory of its own. And therefore, if you are displaying some skill of skiing, driving, or playing an instrument, it is this lies in the body which bring back that memory from the past lives. Now, talking about memory then, that is another argument which is put forward by people. Why do we not remember our past lives if we have lived it before? Once again, in that book, mind you, it is not a conclusive evidence. It is, lots of instances are given of children who have remembered their past lives. Poets have sung about it, says Mr. Judge. Now, children, one after the other instances are there who have remembered what they were, maybe in the last life or in some of the previous lives. One such instance, which we have narrated often from this platform, is about an American girl who was a 4-year-old girl, and always she used to say that whenever she did something, the way she ate her bread or the way she dressed up, oh, I had always done things like this. As if she was a big grown-up adult, she would say, I've always done things like this. And once when the father reprimanded her, she said, I'm going to go away. And the father, the Christian family, he said, where are you going to go away? To heaven from where you have come? And she said, no, I'm going to go away to moon. We have all come from moon. This is of course a very theosophic idea that we have come from moon on this earth. And she also pointed out that it's not for the first time I have taken birth. I have been born before on this earth many times. Sometimes I was man, sometimes I was woman. And one time, I was a soldier in the army. And she used a particular phrase saying that I took the gates. And my name was Lucius Faber. Now, the sister of this girl was studying history, and she took it into her mind to later on investigate and find out the Canadian history. And in a small booklet, she found out that yes, there was a small battle which was fought by a band of soldiers, and in that band of soldiers, they won that battle, and the phrase used was, they took the gates. And it was headed by a lieutenant whose name was Aloysius Lefebvre. So this child was saying, my name was Lucius Lefebvre, and it was Aloysius Lefebvre. Now, there are instances and instances like this where children have remembered. But we say that it is not a conclusive proof. Quite probably, person is able to look into the astral light and pick up some fragments of life from other people's, say, past life. But it is possible that you can bring this memory. Now, why is it that we are not able to remember? The major problem is that in a new life, there is a new brain. And the new brain doesn't have any memory of the past. This new brain has to become porous so as to reflect the memory which is very much there in our soul or ego or whatever we want to call it. That's why in the Key to Theosophy, HPV speaks about three kinds of memories. She says there is remembrance, recollection, and there is reminiscence. Reminiscence is the soul memory. And this soul memory can at times surface when the lower man or personal man is paralyzed. For instance, we can see that during the process of hypnotism, we are told that at times when the brain is paralyzed, it is possible, quite unconsciously, the subject can be taken into regress back into past, and suddenly he can be regressed into his past life. There is a book, Many Lives, Many Masters, that's many instances are given where the person is able to recall many of her past lives. So it is possible when the brain memory is paralyzed, when it is not obstructing, our ego having a perfect memory of all these past lives, for if there is nothing like past, present and future, this memory suddenly finds expression. And of course, we are told that as a perfected being, Buddha was called Sammasambhuti. He could remember all his past lives. In fact, that is what Jataka tales are all about. Jataka tales are supposed to be mentioning all his various lives, not only in the human bodies, but also as a bird, as an elephant, as a tiger, and so on and so forth. So, there is this possibility, but the main problem is our brain. If somehow, if we live a higher, pure life, this brain can be made porous and the soul memory can really find expression. So, this is what the handout quotation says, that the brain is the instrument for the memory of the soul. And being new in each life with but a certain capacity, the ego is only able to use it for the new life up to its capacity. By living according to the dictates of the soul, the brain may at last be made porous to the soul's recollection. And in the next one, it is HPP who points out that nobody can be convinced of reincarnation. You can't convince, even by these arguments, you may go home and say that I am not convinced. Only thing that can convince you is when you put your lower nature in harmony with your higher nature. Then, as we said, you will be able to recall your past life. So she says to get convinced of the fact of reincarnation and past lives, one must put oneself in rapport with one's real permanent ego, not one's evanescent memory. Now there is this other question of good and evil. How often we are at a loss to answer the question, why do good people suffer? And why do bad people seem to go scot-free? And as it be says, virtue in distress and vice in triumph makes atheists of man, because man don't know the doctrines of karma and reincarnation. You have to take into account the doctrine of rebirth, because often, as the heroine of Sound of Music says, when that captain professes his love and says that he's going to marry her and all that, she's very, very happy. And she thinks that I must have done something good. So she says that somewhere in my youth, nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever could. So somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. Now being a Christian, you stop at only this life. You must have done something good in your youth or in your childhood. But what about a life prior to that? So the problem arises when we suffer and we don't find a single reason. A man may have led impeccably good, virtuous life, and yet he suffers. And then we want to know, why does he suffer? And then you are forced to go back to the previous life. As it is said that a disciple was once suffering and he asked his guru that, why am I suffering? And the guru said that, why don't you look into your previous life? And he is made to look into his previous life, 50th life, 51st life, and then he is able to find a cause or maybe set of causes for which he was suffering in this life. So we are told in a way in Raja Yoga or occultism, which Rupi says that the disciple is taught what is called as discernment of fire. It is possible at a certain stage in your spiritual advancement where you can trace back a particular cause, I mean particular effect back to its cause. And you can be made to see that this was the cause for which you are suffering. But at our level we are not given to see this, and therefore we feel, why am I suffering? And then as Light of Asia says, that tomorrow it will judge or after many days. We have to have faith in the law of karma, which may bring results in this life or it can bring results after many many lives. So we say that the mills of God, they grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly small. Which in Hindi they say, Bhagwan ke ghar der hai, andher nahi. That sooner or later, you are brought back the consequences. So this is another thing. And it is because this law of karma and reincarnation explain the problem of evil and good, that HPB and the master says that it is the laws of karma and reincarnation which provide sure and logical basis for practicing ethics. That otherwise you may not want to be moral, but once you are made to see that no matter what you do, you can't escape the consequences of your actions. Just like in the Christian this thing, therefore you are told that fine, you may commit what sins you want, but at the end of your life on your deathbed, you can confess your sins and everything is washed off. You can profess your belief in the blood of Christ, your sins are washed off. Or you may believe that for every newborn baby, a new soul is created. And once again, as Mr. Judd says, where lies the responsibility? It's not the baby who could be held responsible, because God has created that new soul for the new baby. It begins with a clean slate, and for all that is seen and what is happening, baby is not responsible. But then that very terrible question comes. How is it that God on one hand is shown to be very compassionate and just, and the same God on the other hand creates one soul to be born in squalor and dirt and poverty, and the other soul to be born amongst the riches and comforts? And more hilariously, the incidence which is given by HPB in the Key to Theosophy is about the dialogue between a Buddhist monk and the priest, where the Buddhist monk very rightly argues that if your God is the one who has given the moral law, then on the other hand, it is the same God who is creating the soul for every illegitimate baby that is being born. Because all the children that are born in adultery, where is the soul coming from? Is it the God who has created this soul? And then we are told that the priest just looks at his watch and he says, I don't have time to discuss, and goes away. So there are these many questions which would arise, which remain unanswerable unless and until we take into account the idea of rebirth. What about the question of being born in company of people? How is it that there is instantaneous attraction for a person as soon as we meet her or him? There is instantaneous aversion for a person. They have not done anything and yet you feel you don't like the person, or you immediately take to the person. There are some people who come in your life and without doing anything, at every step they hinder you. Or some people, they come and no matter whether you are reciprocating or not, they go on helping you, go on helping you, and then you wonder how. And Mr. Judge, there is an article in Werner Blum's Friends or Enemies for Future, he points out that no man is your enemy, no man is your friend by virtue of your conduct in this life only. He must have been so in the past life, either enemy or friend. And if you are now charitable to the person who is inimical to you, one third of the enmity will be lessened. So that after three lives, from your side, you would have got over the enmity. He may continue to feel whatever. From your side, you have got over the enmity. But if you don't do that, the enmity will continue for three more lives. So this is again something which explains. Sometimes we wonder that how is it that such a terrible child is born to a person or parents who are so pious and good. Or a very pious and nice child is born to parents who are so vicious and bad. And so on. So this is what explains the karmic affinities and our karma of the past lives. Lastly, we would say the last thing that the belief in reincarnation would do is that it takes a great sting from our heart and mind. That is the fear of death. There is again, Eternal Verities has the story about the Socrates and the child, where it is shown in the story that there was a man, a very wicked person, with an open knife he was running and coming towards where Socrates and this little child were standing. Child saw this man coming and he was afraid and started running away. Socrates just stood his ground there. Of course, the man passed away without doing anything, and when the child came back, Socrates asked him that, why did you run away? And the child said that, but he could have harmed us. And Socrates said, well, at the most, well, he could have torn your shirt. He could have bruised you in some way. He could have even run that knife through your body. Could he have killed that in you, which is the real you? He could not have hurt the immortal aspect, which is the real you. He could have hurt your body, but not the real you. And the child said, now I know, Socrates, why you are not afraid of that man. That you are so firmly convinced that we are not the body. So even if this body goes, there is another body. That's what the master writes in one of his letters, that when there was a famine in China, he points out the difference that the portion where the Christian missionaries had sway and people did not believe in rebirth, women, mothers could be seen devouring the children at the time of famine. They wanted to cling to the body at any cost. Whereas, on the other hand, where bonsai, the Buddhist monks had sway, where people not only just intellectually but completely believed that yes, there is rebirth, there multitude was seen dying with utmost indifference. They were not at any cost ready to keep the body and soul together. So this is what is something very important. Something of the dread of death is lessened when we know that yes, there is another life. I don't have to go to any length to keep this body somehow. It has served its purpose. I would very easily and willingly let it go. Of course, we would like to close this lecture with a very wonderful quotation from Key to Theosophy, which actually sums up the whole idea of how important is these doctrines of karma and reincarnation. For logic, consistency, profound philosophy, divine mercy and equity, this doctrine of reincarnation has not its equal on earth. From strength to strength, from the beauty and perfection of one plane to the greater beauty and perfection of another, with accessions of new glory, of fresh knowledge and power in each cycle, such is the destiny of every ego, which thus becomes its own savior in each world and incarnation. We have a few minutes for asking questions. No, I have not followed your question. Can you please repeat? Okay, you die. That is one thing. You have not finished your life's whatever aspirations.
What is reborn in your rebirth? What is recalled in your rebirth? What is it from the past life that comes in one life?
What is it that you carry from one life to another?
What is it that you carry from one life to another?
Yes. What comes back is the new life. The technology is changing. All generations, people are very superficial in all generations. What is it that you carry in your new life?
Well, that's a very large question. In a way, we have hinted at that. What is it that does not die? What is it that is permanent in you? So one aspect of the question would be, what is it that survives death? What survives death is what is impermanent in man, which we call as ego, which we call as experiencer, of which, again, there is no direct evidence, but we have indirect evidences of continuity of consciousness. That when you go to sleep and when you wake up again in the morning, you don't feel that you are a different person, so you know that there is something. Again, when you fall asleep and you have dreams and you wake up again, There is something which is continuing even in the dreams. Isn't it? There is something which is experiencing in the dream. When you recall the dream, again, the example given is in Mr. Judge's letters that have helped me, that once the professor ate duck for his dinner, and then after eating that, he was feeling terrible and he had a nightmare because there was an indigestion. And then he narrated that he saw this duck coming as a big duck with a webbed foot which he was waving at him, and he said, "I felt so terrified, terrified." And Mr. Judge says that there are the same faculties which are terrified of danger in the waking life, the same faculties, and the perceiver is also experiencing something, getting terrified, noting experiences also during dream life. We are just giving you the examples to show that what is that which is bridging the gap of sleep and waking up. Similarly, it is that same entity which continues and bridges the gap between life and death. As to what do you bring with you back all the higher and noble aspirations. HPB gives a list of things: love for good, love for beauty, love for truth, love for the abstract things for their own sake. So it's not as if you will bring back the same knowledge of mathematics which was there 1500 years ago, but the faculty. If you have really pursued the subject of mathematics, technology, there is some faculty which is developed in you. So the very knowledge, the book knowledge, will perish, but the faculty gets added on to the ego, and with that faculty you are born. Just like a musical ability, 20,000 years ago and 25,000 years ago, there may be different kinds of musical instruments, there may be different kinds of technological instruments, but the faculty of operating a technical instrument or musical instrument, that ability becomes part of your ego. So that even when the ego is born after 1500 years or so many years later, that ability that ego carries. And that's why even if a new instrument is there, it will take it little time to get used to it and it will be able to play. So it is the tendencies which we carry, which we call as skandhas. So there is on one hand the ego which comes, on the other hand there is something known as skandhas, the very memory which is divided into five parts: memory of the mind, memory of the body, there is vijnana skandha, there is the memory of the abstract ideas and all that. So this is the memory, not only the way we understand memory, which is what HPB says, it is only remembrance and recollection, but there is memory divided into so many parts, and that is why we talk about five skandhas. There are bodily skandhas, there are skandhas of the mind, there are skandhas which are of the abstract nature, there are skandhas which we call as vedana, that is sensation, and so on. So it is these memories which are not lost, they come back as a kind of efflorescence. So the essence is carried, like the aroma of the flower, the ego carries with it the essence, not the actual knowledge. It is not the knowledge of the languages, but if you struggle with languages, you carry the essence, and in the next life, no matter what language they speak, you will pick it up like this. So it is that essence which is carried and which is helpful. Yes?
I think all philosophies, particularly in the Indian land, there is this concept of 84,000 life. So we are still not born. Which in a way is a, you know, an evolution to from a mineral to the animal world and the higher world. The point is that now, say, whatever is the history of humanity, we know the history of 800 generations at least. What is that that you said? We now, we say in this age, which we have to carry forward, which will lead to the liberation, mukti, of samasta srashti. Deha, kshetra and srashti, if these are taken as an entity, then, and I think here Gandhi.
No, we will not be able to, so we will just repeat, not the entire question, the gist of the question is that what is it that we take along with us, which finally is going to lead to our ultimate goal, which is called mukti, moksha, and so on. Yes, everything is useful, which is a very large question, unfortunately, because that is something which we would deal with in a different kind of a lecture. This was only about rebirth and showing how it becomes necessary. But we would just touch upon it and say that it is not as if all the other knowledges that we are getting and carrying forward is useless. Because after all, we say, as the voice of the silence says, to live and reap experience, the mind needs breath and depth and points to draw it towards the diamond soul. So how is it that your experience gets fruition? That mind, which is right now not able to reflect the glory of your higher divine nature, it has to be made porous. And how can you make it porous? It has to have depth. It has to have breadth. So this knowledge which you consider as worldly knowledge is also of importance. But more than that, there are points to draw it towards the diamond soul. So the crux of the question was that what is it that is finally of importance? It is compassion. It is love. And that is what the voice says is the points. It is the heart quality of mind. It is realizing that we are all one. It is realizing that we are not separate and therefore working for humanity. In one place, HPB points out that it is the tendrils of sympathy, tendrils of sympathy which attach themselves to the ego and they become part of it. So it is the noble qualities, the virtues, the disciplined life, but above all, it is the love and compassion, which is why we say, as St. Paul says, love and do what you will. If you will love, you cannot do anything wrong. So it is really the mother, as it were, the very backbone of living a spiritual life. So that love and virtue is, if we cultivate, that's what is going to give us a trend to going towards high. We'll have to stop this. We won't be able to discuss. Karuna is there. And prajna comes only through that steps which we showed in this thing. We'll just like to close this wonderful, wonderful quotation by Sir Thomas Brown in Religio Medici. We are men and we know not how. There is something in us that can be without us and will be after us, though it is strange that it hath no history what it was before us. Nor cannot tell how it entered in us. There is surely a piece of divinity in us, something that was before the elements and owes no homage unto the sun.